This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
I'm Margaret Brennan in Washington. And this week on Face the Nation, the grim march to reopen the country continues as unemployment soars to levels unseen since the Great Depression. The jobs numbers for April are abysmal. 20.5 million people lost their jobs last month. 33 million have filed for unemployment in just the last 6 weeks. One in seven working Americans are out of a job. Will the president push for more federal aid to help those who are struggling?
Well, we're in a rush. We're in a rush.
The COVID-19 numbers are staggering, too. There are now 4 million confirmed cases worldwide, more than 1.3 million just in the U.S., where the death toll is 78,000 and rising.
As bad as this has been, it's just the beginning.
Despite the dire warnings from medical experts, the do what I say, not what I do mindset at the White House continues as two staffers with close proximity to the president and vice president test positive for the virus, and three top Corona Task Force members quarantine. The CDC recommends Americans wear masks, but that's not enforced at the White House.
Well, I feel about vaccines like I feel about tests. This is going to go away without a vaccine. It's going to go away, and we're not going to see it again, hopefully, after a period of time.
That type of wishful thinking drew a rare rebuke from the president's predecessor. In a recording obtained by Yahoo News, former President Obama called the response anemic and spotty.
It has been an absolute chaotic disaster when that mindset of what's in it for me and to heck with everybody else, when that mindset is operationalized in our government.
We'll talk with White House economic advisor Kevin Hassett, as well as former Google CEO Eric Schmidt. He's now leading a project to reimagine parts of the economy. Dr. Christopher Murray, director of the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, will share brand new COVID-19 projections with us, and we'll hear from former FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb. Finally, with college graduations canceled or going virtual this year, we'll ask the president of the University of Virginia, Jim Ryan, what challenges school officials are facing as they plan for the fall. It's all just ahead on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. We begin today with the financial fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic. The numbers are brutal. The official unemployment rate jumped more than 10 points from 4.4% for March to April's 14.7%. CBS News national correspondent Mark Strassman is in Atlanta. Mark?
Good morning, Margaret. If you think about it, 1 month is all it took. 1 month for the best jobs economy in the last 50 years to plummet into worries about a second Great Depression.
Hunger is motivating.
By 5 a.m. in Connecticut, this grocery giveaway had a line of cars waiting.
We need food. My son-in-law's laid off. My daughter-in-law's laid off. And I'm handicapped.
Nearly one in five mothers with children under 12 now report their families don't have enough to eat. Today's food lines recall soup lines during the Great Depression.
There is a broader unemployment rate, a rate that encompasses people who may be sidelined because they are not actually looking for work actively. And that rate is nearly 23% unemployment.
That is a Depression-era number. Like hunger marchers in 1932, protesters in 2020 pushed to reclaim their piece of America.
You work for us!
And its economy in deep freeze. On this Mother's Day weekend, this protest in Olympia, Washington drew more than 1,000 people. They demanded the governor speed up his reopening plan. Tesla is fed up with California. Let its factory reopen, or the carmaker says it will move to Texas or Nevada. And Florida is reopening salons and barbershops tomorrow.
There was a lot of doomsday predictions for Florida. Those have not borne out.
Maybe not. But last week was Florida's deadliest since its COVID outbreak began. So much about America's economy now rides on the unknown, containing COVID-19, whether the virus resurges later this year, and when people feel safe again. Polls show most Americans expect a full recovery to take at least a year. Some financial analysts argue, count on a decade.
Any hope of what we would like to call a V-shaped recovery, one where you go down sharply and recover sharply, I think that's thrown out the window.
Georgia led the country with its limited reopening. Consumer response has been mixed, and many eligible stores have stayed closed. And in the roughly 2 weeks since the state eased its restrictions, new COVID cases have gone up more than 20%. Margaret?
Mark Strassman, thanks. CBS News senior foreign correspondent Elizabeth Palmer has our report about what's going on in the rest of the world.
Margaret, despite passing that grim milestone of 4 million cases, the overall number of deaths every day is dropping, thanks in part to control measures in New York and, of course, in Europe. But many countries are in the real thick of the crisis. Like Russia. Yesterday was the anniversary of the end of World War II, but there was little to celebrate. In spite of Moscow's ultra-strict lockdown, Russia reported 10,000 new COVID cases every day last week. In neighboring Belarus, in spite of a serious outbreak, President Lukashenko remains in COVID denial.
Hurrah!
He's called it a psychosis and welcomed huge crowds to his country's Victory Day ceremony on Saturday. There were crowds in Brasilia, too, demonstrating in support of the world's other great COVID denier, President Jair Bolsonaro, who still refuses to social distance. Though Rio's famous Christ the Redeemer statue, wearing a mask, shows he's out of step with local officials fighting to control the outbreak. South Korea has opened its baseball season, with masked cheerleaders performing in empty stadiums. Strict measures early on here had almost eliminated COVID, but President Moon Jae-in warned today, it isn't over until it's over, after nightclubs in Seoul had to close abruptly when there was a fresh outbreak. Now it's the developing world that's being closely watched by public health experts. In Africa and Southeast Asia, the virus appears to be spreading more slowly, maybe because the population tends, on average, to be young. But no one is sure, and it might well be that the worst is yet to come. Here in Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson is due to go on television tonight to explain how we get out of our lockdown. And there is some speculation that the roadmap will include a two-week quarantine period, Margaret, for anyone arriving on these shores.
Elizabeth Palmer, thank you. Kevin Hassett is a White House economic advisor, and he joins us this morning. Good morning to you, Kevin.
Good morning.
You called this one of the worst jobs reports ever. We know that this has hit Hispanic and African-American population exceptionally hard, and that these numbers we're seeing likely don't reflect the real pain out there. Where is the bottom to this?
Well, you know, you're exactly right to emphasize that, African-American community and the Hispanic-American community have been hit especially hard by this jobs report, with both of those communities, which were really experiencing record low unemployment rates even in January, seeing massive, massive increases in unemployment. You know, right now, looking across the U.S., there are more than 30 million people that are getting initial claims for unemployment insurance, and that's the biggest negative shock to the jobs market that we've seen since World War II. To get unemployment rates like the ones that we're about to see, to get back to your question, which I think will climb up towards 20% by next month, you have to really go back to the Great Depression to see that. Now, there are a lot of economic differences between right now and the Great Depression. Here, we understand why the economy is slowing down, and we expect that we can reverse it. Whereas in the Depression, there were a lot of other things and a lot of policy errors and so on that made the whole thing drag out. And so I think if you look at the Congressional Budget Office, they currently forecast that the second half of the year will be one of recovery. You know, God willing, that's what's going to happen. And I think that that's the view that's pretty much shared by the White House. And so I think you could expect to see jobs probably trough, you know, in May or June.
May or June would be the low point for unemployment at what? What rate?
That's about what we expect, yeah. You know, I'm looking for rates north of 20, sadly.
North of 20.
Part of this is not really science as much as just arithmetic.
Right. After the financial crisis, it took a decade to get back to employment levels prior to that. You said on Friday that when it comes to this crisis, there's kind of a silver lining in the jobs report that you saw, because you said almost everybody accounted for the increase in unemployment said they expect to go back to work within 6 months. I'm sure they hope to, but isn't that just wishful thinking at this point? You don't know that.
Right. Yeah, nobody knows it. And, you know, and it's very unsatisfying, just like none of us really know, you know, when the virus is going to be either treatable or there'll be a vaccine or, you know, it'll be gone, in which case we could really just go back to our lives. But the fact is that if you think about the things that would happen that would make it hard to turn on the economy, that's like bankruptcies and business failures and so on. And we've built a bridge to the other side by having these small business loans called the PPP loans, mm-hmm. by having a Main Street lending facility so that the Fed is making cash available to big businesses too. And the idea is to try to keep firms up and running, or maybe not running, but up and connected with their workers so that when we turn the switch back on, they can get going right away. Now, again, nobody knows for sure whether it's going to work exactly right. That way, but the Congressional Budget Office, that's their median expectation right now.
If you look at the reality for the people who are getting hit the hardest right now, Brookings says one in every five U.S. children are going hungry. What responsibility does the White House have to respond to that? Don't you need to look at doing things like increasing the amount of money available for food stamps?
Right. We need to look at everything. You know, we've mailed very large checks to like more than 180 million families.
Are you going to have to do that again?
And you're right to emphasize the schools. So many children get two meals a day at school. You know, we've got schools within a few miles of my house here in D.C. where we're really without the school meals. A lot of the kids that go to those schools, the principal tells me, would go hungry. And right now our schools are closed. And those kids who aren't going to school, by the way, many of them don't have internet, so they're not connected to society. It's a terrible tragedy, and we're looking at everything we can do to help with that. And so the White House has an opportunity council that's putting together a major proposal that we expect is going to be part of whatever happens in the Phase 4 deal to fill in the gaps that we're noticing as we watch the data. But absolutely, there's a lot that needs to be done, especially for the most disadvantaged.
So you just referenced a Phase 4 deal. Larry Kudlow, one of the White House advisors, said this week that you're putting off any talks about more emergency rescue packages until maybe even June. Mm-hmm. Why do you think you can wait that
right.
long?
Well, here's what we are doing, okay? We've done this
you know, maybe coming the Fed numbers up to about $9 trillion worth of actions. And now what we're doing is, and the states around the country, you know, are starting to turn their economies back on. And so what we're doing is we're watching very closely what happens. Do those states get their economies up relatively quickly? Does the opening of the state lead to a new outbreak of the disease? We've built a bridge that pretty much, you know, lasts for right. quite a bit of time right now with that $9 trillion. And then the question really becomes, is phase four really going to be extending the bridge because we're not there yet? Or is it going to be focused on growth and making sure that now that we're on the other side, that we have a healthy economy again? And so right now, what mm-hmm. we're doing is basically building a plan for either scenario, and we're going to be ready to act as soon as we need to. But I think that right now, we have bought some time with all the money that we've thrown at the economy, and we've been using the time to do things like develop treatments, improve our treatments, learn more about social distancing yeah. and so on.
But companies and employers need to know what to do to safely reopen. The White House is testing staff regularly. Is that what you're advising America's businesses to do? When will the CDC release specific guidance?
You know, I'm not a doctor. I'm just an economist. And I could tell you.
Well, neither are these CEOs. That's why they're asking for the CDC to provide guidance.
Yeah, no, that's right. But I'm going to say that of course we need to ramp up testing. That's something that the president has heavily emphasized. And just last week we had one day where there are 300,000 tests, and then there's a new test approved that'll hopefully increase that by an order of magnitude. But you're absolutely right that testing is a key component of it. But even testing doesn't remove all risks. And so the interesting or sad thing about my dear colleague who was stricken or with the coronavirus this week is that we were getting tested because we're close to the president every day. And even with that, you know, she tested negative one day and then positive the next day, and she's going to work in a community where people are being tested. And so this is a very, very scary virus, you know, that people are going to go back to work and they're going to be worried about things. And it's going to take a while for things to get back to normal,
yeah.
absolutely. But what we can do is we maximize the chance that happens quickly by making lots of testing available. And that's why we focus so much energy on that.
I didn't hear a date on when that CDC guidance is going to be released. But when it comes to your work environment, you just described, do you wear a mask? Are you going to continue to show up for work at the White House?
You know, I've got a mask right here. The fact is that I practice aggressive social distancing. I'll wear a mask when I feel it's necessary. It is scary to go to work. You know, I was not part of the White House in March. I think that I'd be a lot safer if I was sitting at home than I would be going to the West Wing. But, you know, it's a time when people have to step up and serve their country. And if I think about the amazing accomplishments of the team that we put together that's been down in the basement of the White House, getting data from all over the government to help us decide how to solve the ventilator problem and the PPE problem and everything. But I think everybody knows that going to work, you've been in the West Wing. You know, it's a small, crowded place. It's a little bit risky, but you have to do it because you have to serve your country. And there are a lot of things that you can't do except there. Like if you're going to have secure communications, you need to be in the Situation
right.
Room.
Kevin Hassett, thank you for your time. We'll be back in 1 minute with some new coronavirus projections.
Have you ever covered a carpet stain with a rug? Ignored a leaky faucet? Pretended your half-painted living room is supposed to look like that? Well, you're not alone. We've all got unfinished home projects. But there's an easier way. When you download Thumbtack, it's easier to care for your home from top to bottom. Pull out your phone and in just a few steps, you can search, chat, and book highly rated pros right in your neighborhood. Plus, you'll know what to tackle next because Thumbtack is the app that shows you what to do, who to hire, and when. So say goodbye to all those unfinished home projects and say hello to caring for your home the easier way. Download Thumbtack and start a project today.
One of the national death toll models that the White House is watching closely is from the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. You've often heard it referred to as IHME. And they have some brand new projections out this morning. Institute Director Dr. Christopher Murray is in Seattle, and he joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
What is your model showing you today?
So our projections through till August 4th are up. We're up to 137,000 deaths that we expect to see. And that's the effect of two things going in opposite directions. some goodish news coming out of New York and New Jersey and Michigan, where the death cases and death numbers are coming down faster than expected. Some other states where cases and deaths are going up more than we expected, Illinois, and then Arizona, Florida, California as examples of that. And so it's the balancing of those that is driving our numbers. And then, of course, we're seeing just explosive increases in mobility in a number of states that we expect will translate into more cases and deaths, you know, in 10 days from now.
This is today the second time in about a week that you've raised these projections. What's driving the change?
Well, what's driving the change is, simply put, the rise in mobility, and that's the key driver. We're seeing in some states, you know, a 20 percentage point increase in just 10 days in mobility, and that will translate into more human contact, more transmission. And then the other thing that we're seeing in some states is, which is why we like to revise the forecasts on a very regular basis, is that we're just seeing more cases and deaths than expected in certain places. But it's mostly mobility that's driving up the numbers.
And you are looking at mobility through tracking cell phone data. Is this mobility because of loosened restrictions, or is it just quarantine fatigue and people are going out and about more than they should?
You know, I think it is a bit of both. We're seeing increases in mobility even in anticipation of the relaxation of social distancing, but there's definitely a correlation. The places that are taking off the social distancing mandates, the bump in mobility appears to be larger. So somewhere like Georgia, which was one of the first, we're seeing it's in that category of a pretty big increase. So it's definitely a mixture of both, we believe.
You know, we spoke just before you with one of the White House economic advisors who said one of the reasons they're waiting on more emergency financial aid is because they want to see what happens in the states as they pull back restrictions and whether that leads to a new outbreak of the disease, as Kevin Hassett put it. Do you have any indication that that is happening?
Well, I think that the big challenge here is that when we model the relationship between mobility and transmission, most of the data that's informing that is coming from when people reduced their mobility and we saw a reduction in transmission, you know, namely social distancing works. Now that we're coming out, the big question mark is, will people's own behavior, acting responsibly, wearing a mask, avoiding physical, coming into physical close contact, will that be enough to counteract the effects of rising mobility? And so we really are going to have to wait and see. Our suspicion is that there will be about 10 days from now in these places that have had these big increases in mobility, we are expecting to see a jump in cases.
And what places, what are the potential hotspots in the next 10 days?
Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, the big increases in mobility, there's five states at the top. Some of those have had modest epidemics so far, so they may not be huge numbers. But, you know, the top five in terms of increasing mobility are Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, and Georgia. But there's another 10 states or more where there's being a 10 to 15 percentage point increase in mobility. So pretty diverse. So we may see quite a lot of states tipping towards increasing cases in the next 2 weeks.
Would you advise Americans to travel? The Treasury Secretary was on another network this week, and he said it is a great time for people to explore America. Would you advise them to do that?
You know, I would give people advice. You know, I tend to practice what I preach, and so we're not traveling, my family and I, and have no intention of traveling. And I think it's all part of trying to think about a route back to work and school, and that entails, you know, trying to minimize exposure and, you know, close physical contact, hard to do if you're traveling. So personal advice would be, you know, protect yourselves, wear a mask, and try to minimize interactions with others.
What does the data tell you about how effective wearing a mask actually is?
You know, that's one of the big question marks. We know that the medical masks are highly effective and also very not available, nor is it likely that people are going to feel comfortable wearing medical masks. And so the big question is the effectiveness of cloth masks. We believe they are effective. Just how effective is the subject of a lot of research and discussion. And I think, you know, we just don't have an exact number on it. It's one of these factors that we're going to have to wait and watch and see what happens. The good news is that there's more and more data coming in on who's wearing a face mask. And we may be able to figure out from what's happening community by community across mm-hmm. the U.S., whether those places that are wearing masks more are seeing less transmission. And so, again, more data will teach us more.
We will be watching for that. Thank you, Dr. Murray, for that. We'll be back in a moment with a lot more Face the Nation. The Justice Department dropped charges Thursday against President Trump's former national security adviser, Michael Flynn, who twice pled guilty to lying to the FBI about conversations he had with the Russian ambassador to the U.S. Attorney General William Barr said the FBI did not have a basis for the investigation. We'll be right back with former FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb, former Chairman and CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, and University of Virginia President Jim Ryan.
Every day, our world gets a little more connected, but a little further apart. But then, there are moments that remind us to be more human.
Thank you for calling Amica Insurance.
Hey, I was just in an accident.
Don't worry, we'll get you taken care of.
At Amica, we understand that looking out for each other isn't new or groundbreaking. It's human. Amica, empathy is our best policy.
Welcome back to Face the Nation. We go now to Westport, Connecticut, and former FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb. Good to have you back with us.
Thank you.
We heard from the FDA that they have given emergency use authorization for the first antigen test to discover COVID-19. So that's any substance that causes your immune system to produce antibodies against it. How significant is this authorization? How will this work?
Well, I think this kind of technology is a real game changer. And this test was authorized by the FDA under the leadership of Jeff Shuren, who runs that device center, in 24 hours from receiving the application. What it is it's a very rapid test that can be used in a doctor's office. Doctors now have about 40,000 of these Sophia machines already installed in their offices. And you do a simple nasal swab, and the test itself scans for the antigens that the virus produces. The test is about 85% sensitive. So let's say 100 people come into a doctor's office who have COVID-19, 85 of them are going to be able to be tested positive with this test very quickly. It's a cheap test. It'll probably be about $5 a test, and you can get a result within 5 minutes. For the other 15, the doctors are going to have an index of suspicion that the patient may have COVID-19 and send off one of the PCR-based tests, which take about 24 hours to get the result back. But for those 85 patients that you could screen out right away, you're getting a very fast result, and you can start to take action immediately. The company itself said that they're going to be able to produce about 200,000 of these tests starting right away, but in several weeks they'll be able to produce up to 1.5 million a week. So this dramatically expands our testing capacity as long as doctors are able to run these tests in their offices.
As long as they can run them. How different is this kind of testing from what we've heard so much about, where states are struggling to get capacity and they're looking for, you know, reagents and cotton swabs? Does this solve those challenges?
Well, it helps solve the challenges. I mean, every test paradigm is a little bit different, has pros and cons. The PCR-based tests where the states have struggled to get the testing supplies, those are more accurate, but they also take more time and they cost more to perform. The reimbursement's about $100. Maybe if you do that at scale, you can get the cost down to $50. There's point-of-care-based systems like the Abbott machine that the White House is using or the Gene Expert, which is very reliable. Those take a little longer to get a result. Their sensitivity isn't as good as the PCR-based machines, with the exception of the Gene Expert, which is very accurate. These antigen-based tests aren't as reliable, meaning they're not as sensitive. So they're going to miss some patients who have COVID. But in the hands of a doctor who already has a high index of suspicion that the patient may have the disease, and if they get a negative test and they still think the patient may be infected, they'll send off a PCR-based test. They allow you to dramatically expand testing, and they're very cheap. They're very easy to perform. And again, most doctors have these machines already in their offices. They're using them for strep throat and flu. The challenge is going to be what the guidance is from the CDC and public health agencies about how doctors test in their offices. If turning over a positive case in your medical office means that you have to do a deep cleaning and quarantine your nursing staff and close your office, doctors aren't going to be testing, and that would be unfortunate because there's a big installed base of these tests already in place. So CDC has to come out with flexible guidelines on how doctors can protect their offices and protect their staff and also be testing in the community. Because if we can't do that, then we're not going to have access to testing. The challenge won't be the platforms. There'll be plenty of capacity to perform tests. The challenge will become, where can you go get the test?
You said this could be more accurate than the testing system the White House is currently using. Let me ask you about these aides who have been testing positive at the White House. Our top three medical officials in the U.S. government are now in self-quarantine because of possible exposure. They work in a White House that's a fortress, but the virus has still made it inside. I want to play for you what President Trump said this week when he revealed one of Vice President Pence's aides tested positive.
She tested positive out of the blue. This is why the whole concept of tests aren't necessarily great. The tests are perfect, but something can happen between a test where it's good and then something happens and all of a sudden she was tested very recently and tested negative. And then today, I guess, for some reason, she tested positive.
The president seems to be doubting the value of testing in the workplace. What's your view?
Well, look, I think testing has value in a workplace, especially when you're dealing with places where there's people who are at higher risk of getting infected. So you think about people who work on a shop floor or in a grocery store. The antigen-based test that we're talking about here that was just approved is actually less sensitive than the machine that the White House is using. They're using an Abbott platform. But that platform also has false negatives, meaning that sometimes people are going to have the virus, but the test is going to say they don't. There's machines that are more accurate than that Abbott machine, like the GeneXpert. They take a little longer to perform the test. The reason why the White House prefers the Abbott machine is it gives a result in 5 to 15 minutes. GeneXpert takes about 45 minutes. And so I think that's why they prefer that platform. But this is why we need to have testing out in the community. This is why we need very accurate tests if we're going to be testing asymptomatic people. In the setting of a doctor's office where someone is symptomatic, using a test that doesn't have very high sensitivity might be okay because the doctor's going to run a confirmatory test anyway. But in the setting of where you're testing people who are asymptomatic, as the White House is doing, and you're trying to catch those people who don't have any symptoms, you want a very sensitive test for that kind of a purpose. And that's what we should be using out in the employment setting as well.
We've talked a lot about remdesivir. We interviewed the CEO of the company that makes that drug last week. He told us at that time the government would be deciding who the drug gets to and where. The rollout this week was pretty chaotic. Yesterday, HHS revealed its new plan for distribution. What does this indicate to you about how things will work in the future with other drugs or potentially a vaccine?
Well, look, I think we need to get a better system in place. If the government's going to take control of the supply of these kinds of therapeutics, and they don't necessarily have to do that, they chose to do that, they need to have a good system in place for allocation. Here, in this case, Gilead gave 500,000 doses to the federal government. They distributed initially about 4,000 in New York City, which is a city that I'm familiar with. I think they should have been trying to push out as many doses as fast as possible because more supply is coming into the market. There's no reason to hoard it or hold on to it. And so hopefully when they start to contemplate the next therapeutic, and there will be more therapeutics in the fall or a vaccine and how they allocate that, they're going to have a better system in place based on clinical need.
All right. Thank you very much for your insight, Dr. Gottlieb. We'll be right back with a look at how some businesses may be looking a little different in the near future.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
We want to to go now to the former CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt. He is leading a New York commission to reimagine sectors of the economy in light of the coronavirus pandemic. He joins us from Miami this morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
We just heard from one of the White House economic advisors that the worst is yet to come on the unemployment front. What jobs, in your view, will continue to exist?
Well, a lot will, but they'll operate in different ways. We're going to have to reimagine how the workplace works. We're going to have to figure out how to get people into buildings that they're fearful of. My guess is we'll have more demand for office space, not less, because people will want social distancing. We're going to have to think about hub-and-spoke systems where local people don't travel so far because they don't want to be on public transit for so long. So we're going to have to really rethink how businesses operate. They need their employees back.
After 9/11, in Manhattan, you saw people establish homes outside the city. You saw businesses move and have backup facilities outside of major cities. Is there something that we know is in the works this time around?
You can be sure that something like that will happen. If you think of it as an employer, you have a bunch of employees, some of whom are dying to get back to the office, and some people who are afraid that if they go to the office, they will die. They're very concerned about their immunocompromised or what have you. So they're going to have to come up with flexible arrangements. So imagine that there are three or four people. One will go to the office. One will stay home. Some will go to some local or near their town working environment. It will change the pattern. We've had this situation where people move to super cities in these incredibly concentrated ways. That will change in the next few years. You don't need to be in the super city in order to participate in the excitement of these super cities. The commission, by the way, is intending to work not just on the city, but also suburban and all the rural folks. We have to be sensitive to the fact that everybody has problems, everyone has concerns, and they're very different situations.
You know, corporations are being forced to try to do things in a different way right now, but many of them may use this as an excuse or as an accelerant to make some big strategic shifts. What does the economy look like on the other side of it? What does that mean?
One way to think about this is that this 1 month, 2 months period has brought forth 10 years of forward change. So all of a sudden, the internet is no longer optional. It's fundamental to doing business, to operate, to live our lives. All sorts of much higher expectations as a result. For example, we need much better broadband in the rural areas. Another example would be telehealth. 80% of the visits to doctors are right now on telehealth. People have been wanting this to happen for years. Now, using remote monitoring, we can actually measure everybody and do it remotely. And then only if you have to, you go in to see the doctor. And by the way, that's more convenient for you as a patient. There are all sorts of examples. Another thing that we'll have to do is we'll have to have all sorts of interesting sort of social monitoring of one kind or another to look for these hot spots. So systems will have to be developed to see, oh, my God, there's an outbreak over there. Let's get to it right now before the spread begins.
But one of the things that this crisis has also made obvious is not just income disparity, but access to internet, as you just said. If someone doesn't have access to broadband or they don't have the computer, how do you make up for that difference? Who pays for that?
Well, we have to solve that problem. And when the government does another one of these huge stimulus bills, let's put some stimulus into broadband access, especially for rural areas. The cities are in pretty good shape. And let's figure out a way for people who don't otherwise have access to computers through libraries or whatever, find a way for them to get access. Many people can access through their mobile phones. That's another solution. You can't participate in this new economy without access to the internet. It's how you're going to learn. It's how you're going to deliver services. It's how you're going to market. By the way, it's how you're going to sell, right? Mm-hmm. So salespeople won't be traveling as much. They're going to be doing it with the equivalent of Zoom and other services like that.
But it's not just, you're talking about federal funding to build out infrastructure like Wi-Fi, but what we've learned because of some of these backlogs in unemployment claims with the states is that their basic infrastructure, their computers, are so outmoded they can't even process the amount of demand right now. Where does that come from? I mean, you're talking about not just rebuilding, but, you know, completely remaking how states function.
What you're learning through this is that the government at the federal and state level have just terrible infrastructure in the software department. They're still using COBOL systems, which is a system I programmed in 45 years ago. And those systems, you know, the programmers are no longer with us. So we've really got to upgrade these systems. And there are much better technologies that are much more secure, much quicker, and so forth. You can see them in the private sector. The public sector has lagged for whatever set of reasons. Because of this, this will accelerate all of that. If you look forward to it, what you'll do as a citizen is many of your services will be online. Your health will be online. Much of your education will be online. And then there'll be other systems, like we need to figure out a way to de-densify public transportation. People will say, it's better if you get on the subway now because it's less crowded, right? Because you don't want to be on a subway when it's full of everybody. Mm-hmm. These kinds of changes are easy for computer systems to do if they're in place.
The Wall Street Journal is reporting this morning that the Trump administration's in talks with Intel and some other companies to move facilities back to the United States to have manufacturing be here. Do you see that change in the global supply chain happening?
Well, we've built in the last 10 or 20 years this extraordinarily efficient global supply chain with many, many steps. We've now learned that it's not resilient. There has been for at least a decade a great concern about our over-reliance on Taiwan in particular, but foreign chip manufacturing. And there is an initiative within the government, which is very important, that we get domestic supply of foundries, literally the places where chips are made, and companies like Intel and Samsung and TSMC. TSMC is the largest foundry. It's in Taiwan at the 7-nanometer level, trying to get them into our country so we have better control. It's important from a standpoint of our own economics. It's also important for national security. We want to make sure that our critical infrastructure is owned and controlled by America. Right? Never bet against America. We are the innovators in our world. We should be able to do this well.
We'll leave it on that note. Never bet against America. Thank you, Eric Schmidt.
Thank you.
Will be back in a moment.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
It's graduation season. As students finish high school and college in the next few weeks, the big question that students and parents have is, what will the fall and their future look like? Jim Ryan is the president of the University of Virginia, my alma mater, as well as the alma mater of our executive producer, Mary Hager, and former Face the Nation moderator, John Dickerson. Wahoo-wah.
Wahoo-wah, Margaret.
So you have not yet canceled all summer courses or the fall semester. How do you make this decision? What are you telling parents right now?
So we are in the midst of trying to figure out how we can have as many students back on grounds in the fall and in classrooms, and to do that safely. And we're working night and day to figure out exactly how to do that, and we'll make an announcement about the fall in mid-June. We're trying to push back as far as we can so we'll have the best information when we make the decision, but we also realize that people need to be able to make plans.
Certainly do. But what do you mean when you say, you know, you're taking into consideration health standards? Do you expect to have to test every student before they come back to grounds?
So, you know, I think in order for us to be able to have students back on grounds and in classrooms, there are a few basic things we're going to need. One is testing capacity. I think we would need to test students when they first arrive and faculty and staff before the students arrive. We're going to need to have the ability to do contact tracing. We're going to need the ability to be able to isolate and quarantine students who have been exposed. And then we're also going to need to enact a bunch of social distancing protocols in terms of how far away students need to be from each other in the classroom or in dining halls. As you can imagine, it's a complicated task. College campuses are a difficult and challenging place for contagious viruses.
What you just described is what mayors and governors tell me they have to do. It sounds like you're planning for basically a city. What is the state telling you? Will all Virginia state schools make the same decision at the same time and do the same thing?
So we are in contact with the Department of Education, and I'm also in close contact with my colleagues at Virginia colleges and universities. And we are all trying to work against the same challenge. And my hope is that there will be a set of guidelines that we can all agree to and all follow. But not all of us are in the same situation as well. Some of us have smaller campuses than others. Some are more local than others. So I think we're all following the same principles and all guided by concerns around public health. But because circumstances differ from campus to campus, some might be able to open sooner rather than others. Some may be able to have more students back than others.
UVA has a relatively high percentage of out-of-state and international students. As you look at applicants, you know, how are you taking into consideration not just where people are coming from, but how many people to accept at the university?
Yeah, so international students are a particular challenge. A number of them are not likely to be able to be back in time. So one thing that we know for sure is that we will have courses that are online in order to provide an education to students who can't come back to campus. That may be true for students who are out of state or in state who are at high risk as well. But our admission season this year was remarkably strong. We had a higher yield than we did last year, and we fully expect to have a fully enrolled class when fall comes around.
Higher yield, do you mean more acceptances?
I mean, more people have accepted our offers of admission. A higher percentage accepted our offer of admission than last year, which is a little surprising given the uncertainty.
Right. UVA obviously has a strong athletic program on the basketball front, certainly on the football front as well. Those are also revenue streams. What do you know about the athletic season? What is the plan?
Yeah, it's a great question. We're taking it day by day. Obviously, we need to have students back on grounds before football can begin. But our athletic director, Carla Williams, and our head football coach, Bronco Mendenhall, are committed first and foremost to the safety and well-being of their players, our student athletes. And they'll begin practice when the medical experts tell them that it's safe to do so. Our hope, obviously, is that there's a football season this fall. I don't imagine it will look like normal football seasons, just like I don't imagine, even if we have all students back on grounds, it will look like a normal semester. It will not be a normal semester next fall, regardless of which path we follow.
So, you know, the federal government passed this massive package called the CARES Act, and private universities with very substantial endowments like Harvard and Princeton took a lot of public pressure for even applying for any kind of financial help. UVA has an endowment just short of about $10 billion and did take it. How do you explain that?
Well, we accepted the funding because it is helping our students. Half of the funding that we received goes directly to students in need. We created a student hardship fund that we've been using to provide grants for technology, for online learning, for transportation, for living expenses. And those needs are only going to continue throughout the summer and the fall. So half of the funding we received is directly related to providing assistance to our students. Mm-hmm. The other half reimburses us for costs that we incurred, including rebating housing and dining costs. So we're really passing on these savings to our students. And I think that's a good thing to do.
All right. President Ryan, good luck to you and to all the upcoming graduates. We'll be right back with a tribute to mothers.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Today, we honor and celebrate mothers. They continue to go above and beyond, more so today than ever before. Across the country, moms are keeping households afloat, turning kitchen tables into schoolrooms and home offices. and trying to explain to little ones why life as we knew it disappeared. The reality of gender dynamics is being revealed. 75% of mothers with young children are in the workforce. Moms are the primary or sole earners for 40% of those households, according to the Labor Department. This week, we learned that they're losing their jobs at a higher rate than men.
I was laid off due to a decrease in patient volume. I'm teacher, mom, nurse, provider, everything. I'm all of it. It's a challenge.
The majority of nurses, nursing home aides, and child care workers are women. Those moms must figure out who protects their children while they continue working.
I wonder how much my children suffer from me kind of giving everything at work and coming home to it. Tomorrow's going to be tough because I am going to homeschool all day and I work overnight.
Some of us are mourning mothers lost to this virus in an isolation that robs families of last moments.
Oh my God.
Other first-time moms are unable to hug grandmom and granddad. We cannot gather. But Mother's Day is about celebrating those who gave us life itself. And this year, we are especially grateful for that. And we want to wish all the mothers out there a happy Mother's Day. And to my mom and my mother-in-law, happy Mother's Day, and thank you for all that you do. For Face the Nation, I'm Margaret Brennan. Today's guests were White House Economic Advisor Kevin Hassett, Director of the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington, Dr. Christopher Murray, former FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb, former CEO and Chairman of Google Eric Schmidt, and the President of the University of Virginia, Jim Ryan. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. This broadcast was directed by Allison Hawley. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation and CBS Radio News on Twitter and Instagram. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 11 a.m., 3 p.m., and 6 p.m. Eastern every Sunday.
If you like Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
It was the biggest scandal in pop music. The stars of Milli Vanilli, the Grammy-winning multi-platinum R&B phenomenon, were exposed as frauds, but none of this was their idea. So whose idea was it? Enter German music producer Frank Farian. He saw the success of acts like Michael Jackson and Prince, and he wanted in, no matter the cost. So he devised the perfect pop heist. Two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? They couldn't sing. But Frank knew just how to fix that. Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's greatest controversies and takes a never-before-heard look at the exploitation of two young Black artists. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when the truth came out, Rob and Fab were the only ones who got burned. Looking back now, it's hard not to wonder, why did everyone blame them and not the man pulling the strings? Follow Blame It on the Fame, Milli Vanilli, on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and host of the Money Watch podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary. It is a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money and maybe more importantly, on your life. Follow Money Watch wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.